This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and coming up tonight on 1A Plus with Jen White, a conversation about love, loss, and unrequited love. Author Laura Worrell goes deep with Jen about her debut novel, Sweet, Soft, Plenty Rhythm. Hear more after 6 tonight on 1A Plus with Jen White. Now, if at first you don't succeed, you know how the saying goes, try again. And there could be a link there. Here's a poem, Try Again by William Edward Hickson. If you find your task is hard, try again. Time will bring you your reward, try again. All that other folks can do, why with patience should not you? Only keep this rule in view, try again. Time will bring you your reward for continuing to do an activity that you may not be that great at. But what are our options when we begin but fail, strive but fall short, give up, try something else? What's really in it for us to persevere? We want to hear from you this half hour at 1-800-642-1234. Does this sound like you? Have you recently tried something new, a new sport, a new activity, a hobby, and how did you find it? Were you a master of your craft right out of the gate, or did you strike out like the Brewers did this season? Any backup? Give it another go? You tell me how it went for you at 1-800-642-1234. Our guest is Rachel Feinzig. She is the work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and she recently wrote an amazing article about all of this in a column for the journal called The Case for Allowing Yourself to Be Bad at Something. Rachel, thank you for allowing me to be bad at so many things.
Thank you so much for having me. I could spend the whole half hour just talking about all the things I'm bad at.
Right, that's what I was thinking, is I'm going to have to refrain, and we'll just give out the phone number again and hope others will participate and let us know what they're not so good at 1-800-642-1234. Please, you tell us so we don't have to tell you. And Rachel, what inspired you to write this column?
So I was at a yoga class with a colleague and friend this past summer. I am a runner and I got injured. So I was like that girl, you know, that injured runner in the yoga class trying to fit in with all the experienced yogis. I am so bad at yoga. And I said to my friend, like, I hope after the class, I hope you weren't watching me. And she told me two things. One, no, I wasn't watching you. Like, I don't care, which I think is an important takeaway for all of this. But the second thing she said was, you know, my husband won't even come to yoga with me. He won't do anything that he's not great at. And I just immediately knew I had to write a column about this and why we are so bad at being bad at things.
Well, and how do you get good if you're not bad at it first? And maybe that says more about me than anything else, Rachel, but I certainly had to wonder when I read your article, how does anybody start out of the gate being so brilliant and being able to dance so well? Doesn't
completely
happen, does it?
No. And I recounted my yoga story to someone that I talked to for the story. She's actually a professional mountain biker. And her response was like, what did you expect was going to happen to you at yoga class? Like, people spend years trying to master this stuff. And it often comes with periods of getting worse or staying stagnant. Like, progress is not linear and doesn't come in this kind of like lockstep, you know, way that we expect. And so, yes, I think you're completely right. It's totally normal to be bad at something, especially at first.
Rachel Feinzig from the Wall Street Journal looked into this for us, and I believe at some level we could all relate. What are you bad at? 1-800-642-1234. And Rachel, as you write in the Wall Street Journal, that you heard more profanity while interviewing for this story than you did when you actually did a story about profanity.
I was so, so quiet. I could not believe how upset and like deeply emotionally affected people were as they told me these stories about their failings, about things, you know, that oftentimes were like fairly inconsequential, just in the sense that they were hobbies, things they were doing for pleasure, not like I have messed up this massive part of my life. And yet they were just torn and tortured about it, really.
And it feels that way, and it sounded that way from the interviews and the curse words you couldn't use for your story, Rachel. But it goes towards, and you write about this, social perfectionism, the trend of social perfectionism, that we have to be great. There is no room for error here. But those trends are changing, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what I felt like really made this an important story to tell right now. This idea that all of us have become more perfectionistic over the years. There is research that's been done on this, analyzing students. We all fall somewhere on this kind of scale of perfectionism, and the average is just shifting more to the right, more toward, yeah, that kind of no tolerance for failure, obsessed with how other people are perceiving us. This idea, they call it social perfectionism. I think there's a lot of reasons for it that we can talk about, but I think it makes a story like this just way more pertinent in this moment.
So you are way out of balance at a yoga class, and you think everybody is looking at you, even though they're doing the downward dog, so couldn't even see you unless they were doing the position incorrectly. But there is this sense that, oh my gosh, everybody's looking at me. And the reality is everybody's kind of thinking about that themselves, aren't they? That you're not on a stage.
Oh, completely. And we're all just totally self-obsessed as humans. I know you didn't mean that in like a bad way, but you know, we're worried about how we look as compared to kind of picking apart other people, especially in a situation like this where it's just a yoga class. Like, I wanted to talk to people about all parts of their lives, and certainly some of it was about work, but some of it was just about this kind of plethora of hobbies that people have or side interests. And it was just fascinating to see how people thought about being watched and being viewed.
Mm-hmm. So right now, I want to know what you're bad at. Or if you don't think you're bad at anything, I'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Rachel Feinzig, who is the work and life columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Let's go to Marcia in Stevens Point this afternoon. Marcia, you're on Central Time.
Yes, I'd just like to tell you that I don't consider I'm bad at anything because I do not have an inner critic.
Well, what's that like?
Well, it's fabulous because I don't have to feel bad all the time.
So dancing, singing, it doesn't matter. Ice fishing, there's no way. I mean, you're good at it, or you just don't have anybody telling you that it doesn't matter.
I never considered it matter. If I have fun doing something, what's the difference whether I'm doing it as good as the next person?
If you're having fun doing something, who cares how good you are at it? Rachel, that really resonates with me.
I love that. We should all, me especially, Marcia's my new therapist. What a great advice.
Exactly. And so as I think of this, how do you get rid of that inner critic? Marcia doesn't seem to have ever had it, which I would think might be a blessing and a curse, but how do you shake it?
I think part of it is just embracing the fact that you're a beginner, like telling yourself, reminding yourself that people like helping beginners. It just being kind of honest about it and asking for help can make other people feel like they're the experts.
Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist for The Wall Street Journal. And going back to the idea that everybody's watching you, you talked to a business owner, Elliot Pepper, for your story in The Wall Street Journal, and he had some glaring discrepancies. There were some things he was not great at, but he didn't want to admit it, and it cost him, at least business-wise, on his bottom line. Once he realized that he was able to fill the gaps and do so, his quote was, "People don't care that much." People don't care that much, Rachel.
I know. I love that quote. And I thought it was a really fascinating example because he would go to these networking events for entrepreneurs, you know, where people kind of offer helpful tips, and people would ask, you know, how's he doing? And he would just,
great.
He'd just say, I'm killing it. I'm like, but he couldn't, you know, admit his failings, which were not really about like the substance of his business. He's an accountant and a financial planner, and he knew the ins and outs of all these complicated things, but he couldn't handle things like, you know, collecting on invoices. And so, for him, the answer came from finding a business partner who was A, good at the things he wasn't good at, and B, who he felt comfortable opening up to and learning from. And that kind of just solved the problem.
Let's go to Pat in Green Bay with things we're not so great at and why that might not matter at 1-800-642-1234. Pat, good afternoon.
Afternoon, folks. Thank you for accepting my phone call.
Thanks for calling. What do you got?
All right. So my thing that I am just horrible at is reading people.
That's got to be rough, Pat.
Well, okay, to put it in context, I have, as I like to call it, my side hustle. I'm practicing for retirement. I create woodenwares. So wooden spoons, you know, utensils, mm-hmm. things like that. So I'm always trying to look in the magic crystal ball of what do people want next year? Well, right? I've been doing this for three years. I still don't have it right.
Well, it's just 3 years, Pat. I think you got to give it 30. And even after that, how, I mean, human behavior, that you've really, who would be very good at that, Pat? I would be interested to meet the person who would be very good at that. Rachel, so great with wooden wares, but not easy to figure out what wooden wares people are going to want.
I mean, it reminds me of the Elliot Pepper story, right? Where you're good at doing the thing and and there's this other skill set that's not really central to the doing of the thing that you're missing. So I feel like it's something where you could, you know, just ask someone else for help. And I also think it just goes back to the point of like you said, it's only been 3 years. Everything takes longer than we think it will to get right. It's been my experience.
Rachel Feinzig, that has been mine as well. She is our guest and a work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal, discussing how bad people are at being bad at things. We should get better at being bad, is what we're saying. We don't like it. Rachel's found, and she's here to tell us, keep on trying that thing anyway, especially if it's fun. As Marcia pointed out, if it's fun, what's the point of the rest, right? 1-800-642-1234, your chance to share with us what you're so bad at and why that just doesn't matter. We'll continue the conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our talk with Rachel Feinzig, work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal, talking about a recent column of hers for the journal titled "The Case for Allowing Yourself to Be Bad at Something." And it turns out we're just not that good at being bad. And we're looking for your input this afternoon on what you're bad at and why that might not matter at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Where Jeff and Superior are standing by. Jeff, what are you bad at?
Good afternoon. I'm 62 years old, and I've spent a lot of money in my lifetime trying to become good at carving pumpkins.
Like just the nose and the eyes, or the elaborate three? Yeah.
You know, those young women in their 20s and 30s, they're so effortless. You know, they can do it for the kids. But I don't have that flair, that intuition, or that whatever je ne sais quoi they have. But they seem to do, their pumpkins are perfect. And I destroy a pumpkin when I try to make it, I try to carve it. And I feel sorry for the pumpkin, but trying.
Now, is this something you only do during Halloween season, or is this a year-round practice that you've developed until you put in the hours to become good at it?
Oh, I'm still not good at it. I've put in hours. I've lived in community. I've lived with people. I've even tried to bring this privately so I'm not embarrassing myself.
Wow.
But I keep trying to make a pumpkin that I can say, doggone it, that's a darn good pumpkin.
Well, wrong time of year to be terrible at pumpkin carving, Jeff, but I very much appreciate the call. And Rachel Feinzig, it's interesting because sometimes being great at something isn't that great. And you talk to a pro BMX biker about what it means to be perfect at being a BMX biker, and it just didn't seem, at least for the person that you interviewed, to be fun.
I think it can take a lot of the fun out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, he told me, you know, for him now, because he decided not to go that route of being a professional BMX biker, you do a trick one time, you do it and you enjoy it. And being a professional, you have to do it 100 times until there's no possible way that you could not get it right. And I mean, it wears on people. He found that it was much more sustainable to just keep it as a hobby versus risking injury. He found that a lot of professional BMXers had trouble with money and addiction. And I think there's a sense that keeping something fun oftentimes means not obsessing over perfecting it.
Mm-hmm. And you do it so often that it's muscle memory, that you could do it in your sleep. And once you're doing it in your sleep, where's the fun in that?
I mean, it becomes a job, right? A reason you get paid for jobs. No matter how great they are, they're still not that fun.
Let's turn now to Paul in Northern Illinois. Paul, you're on Central Time with Rachel Feinzig.
Hi, you've inspired me to pivot just a hair, even though my main thing is yet to come. My dad was a professional drummer, played for Frank Sinatra of the Rat Pack. And when I was a young teen aspiring to be just like him, he said, don't do it. You're going to discover that the music business is just going to eat you alive and it won't make you happy. So I keep drums as a hobby.
Yeah.
And I agree with that previous statement. But my thing that I'm really bad at is reading a room. And I feel like my mission in life is to build bridges and connect people. So I don't mind if I kind of play the fool sometimes in order for people to either get a laugh at my expense or just connect.
So, and this is the second time we've heard this, Paul, and and I can relate to it too. Sometimes it's difficult to relate to people. It's tough to know what they want or where they want to go with it. And sometimes it's not easy to read a room. Rachel, we've heard this a couple times now, and it's an interesting take on and a little bit different than your article.
Right, this idea that people are an enigma. I mean, I think it's true, and I think it's probably especially true in this moment after the pandemic, right? I think a lot of people are probably feeling like they have trouble reading a room or connecting to people in the right way or not being awkward, you know, as we kind of like totally gear up and go back to, you know, some semblance of what things were like in 2019.
And I want to go back to a moment, this idea that we don't like being bad at something because we have this sense that we're being watched or that there is an audience. And I wonder if we were bad at something and there was an audience, whether or not there'd be a change in society. If there was, you know, I am a bad dancer. And so if I were to bad dance in front of anybody, whether or not that would make it a little bit easier for all the other bad dancers in the world to shake their tail feather.
Oh, totally. I can't remember who, but someone I was talking to for the piece was like, is there anything better than watching someone just leave it all out on the dance floor? Especially when they're just doing their own thing and it's not like they're some professionally trained like ballroom dancer. I think it leaves room for way more like joy and it gives other people permission to just be themselves. And one other benefit that we haven't talked about yet, but that I heard from a surfer who I talked to for this piece was, you know, in so many parts of our lives, we have to be the leader, the one who's helping other people. She talked about how freeing it was to not have to be good at surfing, to not feel that pressure. It's just can be really liberating.
And we put this up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked people about the stuff they tried and were bad at it and what happened. We got a response from Pete who said, I took guitar lessons earlier this year, started off great, but once we got into chords, I struggled. Wasn't putting in the practice time I needed, and then when the summer came, I said I was too busy to continue the lessons, but I wish I had learned guitar. And Pete got a supportive response from Paul on Facebook who says, get back to the guitar, guy. Chords are not that bad if just learn the basic ones. He says, I struggled too, but my daughter encouraged me to get back at it. And now I play in jam bands on Saturdays. Well, get back at it. And you know what's interesting? I've tried to play guitar too. And the one thing I realized is it hurts. You need calluses to do that. So right out of the gate, it's not something you're going to be good at no matter what. But there is this sense that, you know, if you stick with it, you'll be at least good enough to not have to hide it. Right?
Well, yeah. And I also think that there oftentimes does have to be a certain level of being good at something to have it be enjoyable. So to reach that, like, you know, something of a flow state where you feel like you're doing it, like the surfer that I talked to, I mean, ideally, like to get up on a wave, you know, is like this exhilarating feeling, or to be good enough in the water that you can paddle out and be there experiencing it. So, I mean, I'm all for being bad at things too, but I do understand this idea that, you know, I think that for me, if I was just better at yoga, I could do more of the poses and I would be in more of like a flow state, you know, during the class.
So have you gotten back to yoga, Rachel?
No, I totally have given up and just gone back to running. I it's true. I ran away from the yoga as I could.
I've given up on guitar too, and it turns out I'll just have soft fingers and that'll be the way it's going to be. But since you published your story in the Wall Street Journal, what kind of feedback have you received? Have you heard more bad stuff?
Yes, golf has been a big theme for people. A lot of people feeling bad about their golf game. All kinds of things that I haven't even thought of. People have told me about their hobbies, things that they ditched, and then things that they, you know, pursued and eventually got great at. You know, I think photography was mentioned. It's been fascinating to hear people's. I really feel like it goes to the heart of how we feel about ourselves as humans.
Yeah, and I feel there's like a Venn diagram here somewhere where if we're bad at a thing but we enjoy the thing, it's a good idea to keep doing it. But if we're bad at it and don't like it, then we don't need to keep doing it at all. And should we keep doing it and holding out for something to turn around? What do you think?
I think only if you really want to. I think, like I said, reaching that flow state, if it's something where you really think the payoff is going to be there, like some things just are kind of miserable to learn. Snowboarding, for example, you are like on your butt and it is cold and it costs a lot of money. But I think you do, if it's something that's important to you, that you really feel in your gut that you've always wanted to do. And I heard that from a lot of people. I heard that from so many people. I always wanted to do this. And only now that I'm like 70 years old and in retirement, did I give it a go. And it's as great as I thought. It's like, don't wait until retirement, you know?
Right. Rachel, I would ask you, what advice would you give for someone who's struggling either with a new skill or an old skill or something that they've left behind but still think about and considering giving it up or picking it up? But again, what would you say to them?
I would set a timeline and just totally embrace the fact that you're going to be bad for the first like X period of time. Give yourself, if it's snowboarding, like give yourself X number of lessons, and you know you're going to be bad, and you're going to go in there to the instructor and say like, I'm bad, but not in like a self-deprecating, like, you know, like fishing for compliments way, in like a I invite your help and expertise kind of way, and I so appreciate like what you can do, your talents. I think that having that attitude for a set period of time is a good way to go.
Rachel Feinzig, thank you for making us feel that bad can be so good.
Thank you so much for having me.
Work and life columnist for the Wall Street Journal. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new term for the U.S. Supreme Court has experts expecting new legal precedents that could change the law of the land. We'll find out what that might mean for Wisconsin. But first, state lawmakers approved a plan last month to spend millions of dollars to combat the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin, and the funding's part of a national settlement with four companies accused of fueling the crisis. The state's share this year is about $31 million with funding for treatment and recovery facilities, tribal nations, and the overdose treatment drug Narcan. We're going to hear a few perspectives on this plan, starting with one of the Republican lawmakers who worked on the version that was ultimately approved. But we also want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What do you want to see this opioid settlement money go to? How has opioid addiction touched your life or your family's? And where do you think funding could make the biggest difference now? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Mark Bourne, Republican representing the state's 39th Assembly District, which includes Beaver Dam. Also the co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, Representative Bourne, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
If you would, please start by walking us through some of the things that you funded with this $31 million in settlement money.
Well, we knew that this is an important issue. It's something that the legislative Republicans have been working on for about a decade. And so we wanted to build on some of the successes of our HOPE agenda. We wanted to focus on a variety of areas in prevention and treatment and education, make sure that we were focused on specific programs that we knew could be successful and that would not take a lot of time to develop. Because especially with this first round of settlement money, we wanted to get some money into the communities more quickly and really start to address more of these issues. We know that drug use and overdoses have increased both during the pandemic and since then, and really wanted to make sure that we got some real bang for the buck, so to speak. And so whether it be expanding the Narcan Direct program, providing some funding for fentanyl strips, you know, to help directly with those overdoses, partnering with our K-12 partners, as well as groups like the Boys and Girls Club on education initiatives that are available to help, and putting more money into things like medication-assisted treatment, which we know has had good successes in communities as well as in jails, a variety of things. Those are a few of them, but mostly the focus was on trying to make sure that we went into programs that either existed or community partners that existed that we knew could be helpful in immediately trying to address this issue.
And Representative Bourne, you mentioned the overdose treatment drug Narcan. Could you tell us how the funding specifically for Narcan would be used?
There's a current program, and this plan puts another $3 million into that program to get Narcan more widely available in our communities. One of the things it prioritizes is law enforcement and first responders. That's something that was very important as we worked on our plan that was different than what the administration put forward. We know that our public safety partners, whether it be police, sheriff, fire, EMS, those are the boots on the ground in our communities. Those are the men and women that are on the front lines helping us in a variety of ways. And this situation with overdoses and combating opioids is certainly an area where they're on the front lines. And so the Narcan program is one where they can be immediately there to help save lives. And so it's a program we have, and this expands on it, uses some of these funds to expand on that.
Representative Mark Bourne, our guest, he is a co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee as they have approved the settlement spending for the settlement funds for this year and the opioid legal settlement money for Wisconsin. And if you have questions, 1-800-642-1234. But I have to ask you, Representative Bourne, if the $3 million for Narcan spending, additional spending, would be enough to make a meaningful difference across the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, we think so. I mean, we think that we wanted to make sure we impacted things in a variety of areas, and so that's obviously one. But, yeah, I think that that'll have a meaningful impact, and certainly our community partners thought that and part of that discussion. And this is one area where we also agree with the Department of Health. Their funding was at the same level.
And Representative Bourne, funding for family support programs was taken out by the Joint Finance Committee. Why did they make that decision?
Yeah, like I mentioned, we wanted to work on programs that were already established or partners in our communities that already had established programs with this first round of funds. There will be additional settlement funds and additional plans in the coming years, and some of these new programs might rise to the top with those or with other funding. But we wanted to make sure that we had more of an immediate impact and not just have bureaucrats in Madison creating new programs and spending months or years trying to develop a new program. So that was really the focus of partnering with, you know, groups like the Boys and Girls Club, our public safety partners, medication-assisted treatment partners, providers throughout the state, organizations like Meda House in the Milwaukee area. There are a lot of partners out there already, both public and private sector, that are doing great work in this area, and we felt it made more sense to focus this first round of settlement money on those type of programs and not spend months or years developing the new programs right now.
Let's go to Philomena now over the phone at 1-800-642-1234. She's in Bad River, and Philomena, you're on the air with Representative Mark Bourne.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. So the Bad River community has had an active harm reduction program in place for the last 8 years. And our focus with Narcan procurement and provision has been with people who use drugs. This has resulted in thousands of overdose reversals, many, many more than what have been accomplished by law enforcement officers. So, you know, I'm hoping that the legislature, the Joint Finance Committee,
Oh, I think we lost you, Philomena, and I apologize.
Opioid settlement.
We lost you there for a second, but Representative Bourne, with the time we have, is there money set aside for our native tribes in Wisconsin in dealing with the opioid addiction?
Definitely. They would both be, since she was specifically looking at Narcan, that would be available in that. But also there's $6 million targeted specifically to the tribal nations, and something that certainly they could develop those programs with those funds as well.
Representative Bourne, you've got a background with the Dodge County Sheriff's Office, as I understand it. And from a law enforcement perspective, what do we do about addiction? Narcan saves lives, but what do we do to end the cycle of addiction? And what role do you see law enforcement playing in that?
I think they play a major role, and that's why we prioritize grant funding for law enforcement when the Evers administration targeted them for $0. And that's because we know that those are the folks in our communities right there that can help. And I think too often people think of law enforcement as only the arrest or the enforcing the crime part of it. And instead, they're usually parts of the education program and the prevention programs. And if I think about in my community, all of the places where you can dispose of your narcotics that you don't need anymore at home are in sheriff's departments and police departments. They're not something that you find at a state building or at a human services building, because these law enforcement and public safety folks are all over our state. So there are logical places to be helpful. Another one is the sheriff's department, which, as you mentioned, I used to work for years ago. I worked in the jail. The medication-assisted treatment in the jail is a huge thing. We're having success with that in Dodge County, and I know in counties throughout Wisconsin, and some of those grant funds could be used to expand those programs and help people get off of these drugs and when they get out, not get back on them and be productive members of society. Those are huge opportunities for a variety of problems in our system.
Representative Bourne, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
State Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam with us today to talk about the Republican written plan to spend millions of dollars in opioid settlement funds. That plan was approved by the legislature's Joint Finance Committee last month. Now up next, we'll hear more perspectives on the plan from the head of an addiction advocacy group in Beloit and an expert on the opioid epidemic. And you can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234. Is opioid addiction something you've experienced or someone in your life has? And what resources helped you? How do you beat the cycle of addiction? 1-800-642-1234. Sharing your story may help others. Email us if you wish. ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation about a plan that state lawmakers recently passed to spend millions of dollars in opioid settlement money to deal with the addiction across the state. And we'd like to hear your story at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our next guest, Tracy Burtis, is the founder and president of the Beloit advocacy group Families Fighting Addiction. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Also joining us, Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, specializing in opioid addiction medicine and public health at UW Health. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to start with you, Doctor. Does the spending plan passed by the state legislature fund the kinds of things that Wisconsin needs to make a difference in this opioid epidemic?
That's a great question, and I think one that can be hard to answer because sadly there's so much work that we still have to do. I was in many ways pleased to see that they were thinking broadly in terms of covering prevention, treatment services, recovery supports, and harm reduction services. At this early stage, I think so much of the devil's in the details, as they say, in terms of how things are implemented, how we are strategically considering which communities have been impacted, and finally, really ensuring that community has voice and how these funds are being distributed and spent, and making sure that we have key players, particularly people with lived experience themselves, as well as families and friends of those individuals at the table as we're thinking about implementation across these various areas.
And Tracy Burtis, you've had this lived experience. You lost your son 5 years ago to an overdose. You yourself are a nurse, and you thought, you save people for a living so you could save your son. As you look now at what's ahead for dealing with the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin, funding for you're working on this issue on the ground. So what to you is the most important funding need when it comes to the opioid epidemic, Tracy?
Well, I agree with Dr. Afshar. There's so many different things that have to be done. We are behind the eight ball here because there's so many deaths. So we can't just start with prevention. We're going to have to hit everything all at once. And it's my opinion that we need to first stop the deaths and then start from the beginning, because we are really, really quite far behind in all of this.
And Dr. Salisbury Afshar, how important is funding for Narcan in this fight just to keep people alive?
I think continuing to fund naloxone is, or, and I use the term naloxone because that's the generic name, but same thing as Narcan, is really critical. But I would just sort of double down on what the previous caller stated, which is that available evidence really supports that the people most likely to save someone's life are people who use drugs themselves. We know that they are likely to be in around other people who use drugs. We know that they are really, really resourceful and really adept at knowing how to support their community. You know, for my clinical practice, I solely work with people who use substances. And I know firsthand that a lot of people are really afraid to call 911 because of the potential legal repercussions. And so that's not to say that I don't think police or paramedics or others should have access to naloxone, but in terms of prioritization, all available literature would support that people who use drugs should be the first priority in terms of ensuring access.
Mm. And Tracy Burtis has mentioned you've been in this position. Can you share a little bit about what it's like for families with a loved one struggling with addiction?
Sure. There's nothing worse than feeling completely powerless to help those that you love, a life you love more than your own. And you're unable because you don't have the tools available to save them. It's horrifying for any parent and any loved one to endure that.
And were you, I mean, was there concerns about bringing in law enforcement into the equation? Was there fears that this might not be the helpful way to go? I mean, how did you decide what to do, where to go, and who to turn to?
Well, back 5 years ago, there wasn't anywhere to go or anybody to turn to. But I hear every day, all the time, we've just recently lost another one where they had started CPR and then left. And by the time the EMS got there, the young gal had brain damage and died on the way to the hospital. So it's happening all the time. And I think the more people that have the Narcan, the tools that they need to save the lives, if they have that available, the better. And that means everybody.
Tracy Burtis is the founder and president of the Beloit Advocacy Group, Families Fighting Addiction. Also joining us, Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, specializing in opioid addiction medicine and public health at UW Health. And we'll take your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Lisa in Amberg standing by. Lisa, you're on Central Time.
Yes, I used to be a nurse, and I have a pet peeve. I went through training as a nurse in the 80s when the pharmaceutical companies were convincing the doctors that you couldn't over-medicate for pain, that if a person had pain, that they would not become addicted. I specifically remember being taught that. And you have a whole generation of doctors that went through that school that may or may not be on the eight ball, so to speak. But a pet peeve I have is that we acknowledge that the pharmaceutical companies created the majority of this problem.
That's where the money came from.
The people, right? But most of the people that are victims, we acknowledge that they are victims of the pharmaceutical company, but we criminalize them. We arrest them. We put them in jail. Then they have a record, and it's even more difficult for them to function in society, to be able to find a way out. And what upsets me is we claim that we don't have the money to take care of this problem, or there's not enough money to take care of this problem. And I'm not suggesting at all defunding the police. I don't mean it that way at all. But if we put some of the money that they're spending in housing and arresting these people and feeding them in jail and made more beds available for treatment, it would help a lot more than arresting people.
Lisa, thank you so much for your perspective. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, are we doing any law enforcement-assisted diversion, this community-based diversion approach, which takes people who would be considered low-level drug or criminals and takes them into a process of beginning the treatment and recovery from addiction? Do we see that in Wisconsin?
I am not in the best position to be able to answer across the entire state regarding what is or what isn't happening as it relates to diversion and deflection. But I would just like to go back to something that was just said. And I think just say, you know, again, in working with people with addiction, this is something that I see all the time. While folks are active in their addiction, many end up getting some type of charges, often charges for sort of very small amounts of possession of substances. Sometimes people even end up, their sole charges are related to surviving an overdose. So because they have a small amount of substance or they have substance paraphernalia on them at the time of their overdose, they end up with these charges that stay with them for the rest of their lives. That then makes it harder for them to get jobs. It makes it harder for them to get housing. If they have children, it makes it harder for them to maintain custody of their kids. And it really does sort of box people into a corner in terms of future opportunities. And so, you know, again, my space is more in the sort of healthcare treatment, recovery services, harm reduction space. So I don't want to say as a blanket that this never happens anywhere in the state. But I do think it's really important to acknowledge that science and medicine really support the idea that we should be doing everything we can to support folks, and the idea that you know, simply locking people up is going to somehow help them. We don't see that play out in the evidence, and I also don't see it play out in my clinical settings. And so I think anything we can do to really try to work with folks with addiction to ensure that they have the right services and opportunities to be able to, you know, find a new path is where we should be focusing.
And Tracy Burtis, you advocate for something called a Good Samaritan law in Wisconsin. Tell us about it and what chance you might think it has of becoming a law in the state.
Well, it's something I've prayed for years, and they're still working on it, apparently. And basically, it's a blanket law that anybody that is attempting to save a life because of an overdose, and if they call the 911 and get help for that person, which is necessary, that they will not be held accountable and will not have to even answer questions about the drug use, whether or not they gave the drug to the person that overdosed, whether they have any, if they have, maybe they're on probation or parole, you know, none of those questions will be asked because doggone it, they're trying to help save a life. And that's what you're looking at, is just that with that law.
Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, I'm making you a co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee in the Wisconsin Legislature. And so now you have the purse strings here for the next round of funding for dealing with the opioid epidemic in Wisconsin. Where would you put that money? What's your priority?
I love the idea of having the purse strings. I think that the challenge in this space is that you know, the goal should be that these funds are used to augment and supplement where other sources of funding are already going. And I will not pretend that I have that broad understanding. I will say in my work, there are a few areas that I see where we have major gaps, and I am not aware of any funding going to these areas, either through this settlement fund or through other existing funds. Specifically, one is really recovery housing. So I know that, you know, supports for residential or something that we're in here, but we see so many folks who, even if they can get access to residential treatment, when they leave residential treatment, they have nowhere to go. And going back to the streets or going back into their previous environment is really problematic. There are a lot of other things we could do on the recovery support side as it relates to job training, job placement programs. Additionally, you know, although we're putting a lot more money toward treatment services, it doesn't mean that we automatically have enough clinicians in this space. And so really ensuring that we have a pipeline for substance use counselors, for peer recovery coaches, for all types of addiction treatment professionals, to be able to train people, recruit and retrain individuals, and ideally individuals who represent the communities they're serving. So those are just a few of the areas. And then the final thing I would say on this note is that, as Tracy mentioned, you know, there is an absolute crisis at this time, and we need to simultaneously be thinking about everything, including prevention to treatment, recovery, and harm reduction. And on the prevention side, you know, we understand that living in poverty, we understand that lack of housing, we understand that lack of educational opportunities, we understand that co-occurring mental illness, all of these things increase risk for the development of addiction. This needs to be a multi-sectoral approach. We can't expect opioid settlement money to quote unquote fix everything. It has to be something where we're all coming together and thinking holistically about the services and supports that people need, both to prevent the development of addiction in the first place, but also to support people who have addiction and or are recovering from addiction.
Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, thank you so much for joining us. Also, Tracy Burtis, our guest this this afternoon, taking a look at the opioid settlement funds available in Wisconsin and where best to put them. Conversation continues. You can always email us ideas@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Central Time on the Ideas Network.